Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I make this at home as well, like to keep for deli sandwiches and things like that, just because, you know, regular mustard's kind of boring.
Chef Seth Elger makes mustard with eggs and beer, and he also introduces us to the easiest pasta recipe there is, Spätzle. We'll look forward to a day in the kitchen at his restaurant, NoCo. We hear from Harvest Public Media that advancements in biotechnology are outpacing regulations. Then we visit a small town in Indiana to hear how a new confined animal feeding operation, or CAFO, is impacting property value and quality of life for its neighbors. And food startups get a leg up at the One World Kitchen Share facility. Headlines from the Food and Farming Beat. Here's Mark Chilla.
A new UN report says the world's oceans are strained from overfishing as global demand continues to rise. In a biennial report on the state of world fisheries, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization said nearly one-third of worldwide fish stocks were caught at unsustainable levels in 2013. The report forecasts that fish production will increase by 17% by 2025. But that won't keep up with surging demand, with world fish consumption set to increase by 21%. Researchers also said the amount of farmed fish is set to surpass the amount of wild-caught fish for the first time by 2021. Overall, suicide rates have climbed more than 20% since the year 2000. According to a preliminary study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, farmers, along with fishermen and foresters, make up the group most likely to die by suicide. CDC researchers suspect farmers and fishermen are more likely to take their own lives because their work is often located in isolated rural areas where it's harder to access mental health services. Plus, the jobs are stressful and income can be volatile and unreliable. The report also noted there is some evidence that farmers' exposure to pesticides may contribute to mental health problems. And Americans bought twice as many bags of packaged salads as heads of lettuce last year. And over the past 5 years, sales of bagged lettuce have been increasing by 6.5% every year. That's according to the Nielsen Perishables Group. NPR saw these numbers as a chance to dig into some facts and misconceptions about bagged salad greens. Despite last year's high-profile listeria outbreak in Dole brand bagged salad, the chance of foodborne illness from bagged lettuce is no higher than from traditional wash-at-home lettuce heads. In terms of freshness, it's fair to say that chopping and shredding can lead to browning and wilting. But large producers process and ship their products to retail grocery chains and food service outlets with pretty impressive efficiency. The lettuce also benefits from something called modified atmosphere packaging. That means the bags help minimize browning and spoilage with lower levels of oxygen and more carbon dioxide. When it comes to nutrition, NPR found plenty of opinions and not so many facts. You can read this article at eartheats.org. And Twitter is the place to go for even more news stories. We post recipes there, too. Find us at twitter.com/EarthEats.
One more big news story from the week. The House overwhelmingly passed Senate Bill 764, the GMO disclosure bill, with a 306-117 vote. What this means for food labels at eartheats.org. Thanks to Taylor Killo and Chad Bouchard, our bloggers, and, of course, Mark Chilla.
No, thank you, Annie.
Scientists are cracking the code of life. They can copy and paste DNA to make disease-resistant pigs or plants that kill pesky insects. But how do we know these new crops and animals are safe? As Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, regulators are struggling to keep up.
In a brightly lit lab at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, workers with tweezers hunch over petri dishes scattered with sprouted seeds. The seeds are sorghum, a crop that grows grain, and also builds a strong, sugary stalk. Plant scientist Tom Clemente says this sorghum has a genetic tweak. Instead of sugar in the stalk, it's engineered to make oil, which could be used to make fuel or chemicals.
You know, if we can get oil in a stalk of sorghum anywhere greater than 5%, that's a winner. It's a grand slam.
Imagine a new drought-resistant crop for farmers, a new source of biofuel. But if this technology is going to reach the field, Clemente says it won't come from a lab on campus. It'll take a big seed company to carry it across the finish line. Think Monsanto or Syngenta. Getting a new genetically modified plant to farms takes years of field trials and repetitive studies. It can be too time-consuming and expensive for the public sector or small startups. Clemente says if seed companies don't see dollar signs, new technology can wither away.
We still push forward with the innovations, but the frustrating part is there's a lot of technology sitting on the shelf in Nebraska, in Illinois, in Missouri that'll never see the light of day because of these regulations.
That's just one complaint about federal oversight of biotechnology. The time and money it takes to bring new products to the public are stifling innovation. But there are other problems. Three government agencies share the job of regulating biotechnology: the Food and Drug Administration, Environmental Protection Agency, and the Department of Agriculture. But the last time they updated their regulations was 1992. A wave of new discoveries is breaking out of that old regulatory framework.
How we make things is going to change in an absolutely fundamental way.
That's biotech investor Juan Enriquez, speaking earlier this year to a scientific panel reporting to the government about trends in the industry. He told them inventions like gene editing and programmable cells could transform everything from agriculture and medicine to energy and manufacturing.
And it's going to make the industrial revolution, the digital revolution, maybe look a little unsophisticated.
Last year, the White House told the three federal agencies to update the regulatory system and open a simpler path for new biotechnology. A joint proposal is expected by this fall. Enriquez says regulators have a tough challenge.
You have to have what is almost impossible to have in today's political climate, which is a nuanced debate.
Does the government need to put all engineered crops and animals under the same microscope, or should some technologies just get a once-over? For instance, scientists in Minnesota have edited a milk cow's DNA so it doesn't grow horns. Right now, horns are often cut off on the farm. Yes, it's genetically modified, but it's all the same cow DNA with just one tiny piece missing. They say it's just as safe as conventional breeding. But others want regulators to remain skeptical.
It's like, you know, pulling a string, you know, on a cloth. Maybe that thread will break and you know, the garment stays intact. Maybe it won't.
Doug Gurian-Sherman is a scientist with the Center for Food Safety. He agrees that hornless milk cows are probably harmless. Still, he argues regulators should monitor all these altered organisms to catch unforeseen side effects. And there's another reason to keep track of what's engineered. How else would you know whether a product needs a special label?
We could have products entering our food supply in the marketplace that the public is completely unaware of.
Gurian-Sherman says casting a wide regulatory net provides the most transparency. But researchers like Tom Clemente in Nebraska say that's not a good scientific reason to regulate.
The debate is around regulate based on science. The way we introduce these traits through the tools of biotechnology are as safe or safer than what we have done through conventional crossing.
He says regulate where the risks are, on traits that could impact health or the environment, not on types of engineering that are shown to be safe. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Take a moment today to connect with Grant and the other reporters on Twitter at HarvestPM and online at harvestpublicmedia.org. Chef Seth Elger is always smiling, even when he's running a little bit behind, like today. He's already sweating as he gets the ingredients set for two recipes. He's still the chef and general manager at NoCo in Bloomington, Indiana. But the restaurant has moved to a new spot downtown, and in this new spot is a big new kitchen. There are three sous chefs working on the day's tasks while Seth and I cook up some German-style dumplings.
All right.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Doing just fine. How about you?
All right. So what are we doing today?
We're making Spätzle.
Spell it.
Spätzle.
And I guess it would have an umlaut if we're talking Auf Deutsch?
I believe so, yes.
Making your own pasta to me sounds like one of those dishes that seems too impossible to even attempt.
Oh, the spätzle is so easy. Because you're not rolling it out or running it through an extruder, spätzle actually translates in German to, my understanding is, sparrow's wing. And so it's supposed to be a rough, rustic kind of dumpling style pasta. And it's not a highfalutin Italian pasta by any means. So like a lot of simpler pastas, I've got egg whisked here. It's got a little bit of lemon zest and some whole grain mustard in it. And I'm going to add some milk. Whole milk. Fat is flavor. So I'm going to add our dry ingredients. We've got flour and salt and pepper. And one key flavoring ingredient for spätzle is nutmeg.
Tastes a little like Christmas?
A little bit. Lots of German things taste like Christmas. So we've got some boiling water here. And I'm putting my perforated pan over. And all we're doing, we're grabbing a cup or so of the pasta at a time. Just scraping it against the perforated pan, rains into that boiling water, and then we just wait for them to rise. As soon as they rise, pasta is done.
Is this is the gateway to then making maybe more complicated pasta?
Yeah, I think it's a good confidence booster for people who have never made pasta before. So as you can see, they're not perfect by any means. They're very organic looking little dumplings.
He pulled them out of the boiling water and plunged them into cold water to stop the cooking. We're going for crispy on the outside and chewy on the inside. So now it's into a hot buttered pan for our spätzle.
You hear the butter hitting the pan, nice and hot. For the lack of a better word, we do want to fry this up a little bit. And we're going to add our spätzle. We don't want to stir it too much here at the beginning. You actually want the spätzle to brown, because everything's better with brown butter. All right, so our spätzle's done. We've got that gorgeous brown color here.
He garnished it with a lemon wedge and some fresh parsley. What if I told you could make beet spätzle? Seth said to do that, just use 2 eggs instead of 4 and 1/3 of a cup of milk, and then add a half a cup of beet puree. Then these little dumplings will be a bright pink. We've written out that recipe on eartheats.org so you can follow it easily. The mustard in that spätzle recipe was store-bought whole grain mustard, but making your own mustard is really easy, he says.
A lot of them, it's simply bring vinegar up to a boil, throw it over the top of your powdered mustard with your other seasonings, and stir it in, and a lot of them are done at that point. This one's a little bit different because of the beer and the egg. We have to cook it a little bit longer.
He's getting ready to co-cook a German dinner that will take place on a local farm to give diners a true farm-to-table experience. This mustard will go with some sauerbraten.
We're almost cooking, for lack of a better description, mustard custard. We're trying to cook this just until the egg thickens the mustard sauce. And as soon as this takes on more of a velvety, almost like hollandaise kind of consistency, then we're going to pull it to the side and let it cool down. And it's totally done at that point.
On the stove, he's created a double boiler with a big pot of water and a bowl that fits over top and gives a couple inches of space between the water and the bottom of the bowl.
So it's not something we have to stir perpetually. We whisk it every couple of minutes. You want to take a rubber spatula and clean the sides of it. If the eggs were to scramble a little bit, you can actually even take this and throw it into your blender or food processor. Smaller batch here, so this one is definitely cooking up a little bit faster. As you can see, we've got protein setting here to the outside, and our powdered mustard is thickening up too. So we just cook this, like I said, until we get that rich, thick viscosity, and we cool it down. This is great for sausages. I make this at home as well, to keep for deli sandwiches and things like that, just because, regular mustard's kind of boring.
Try your hand at ketchup, an aioli, and a green goddess dressing. More condiment recipes at eartheats.org. Coming up, we meet a couple food entrepreneurs who are able to expand their business because they rent kitchen space. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. It's a good day at Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Indiana is adding more large-scale hog farms every year. They're good business for farmers, but some neighbors say they can be bad for property values. It's an argument people are having across the state, especially in small towns like Hope. Population 2,200. It's in Bartholomew County, and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek brings us a story.
Nancy Banta heads up the gravel driveway to her farmhouse. The rocking chairs on its whitewashed wood porch look out over a cornfield, and a wind chime hangs over the creaky screen door.
This is who I am. It defines me.
Her family has lived here in Hope for almost 200 years. The town's 2,200 residents are some of the poorest in Bartholomew County, and that's led some farmers here to start building more large-scale hog farms. They generate free manure to fertilize crops and bring in extra cash. The newest is a half mile from Banta's house, a short white barn 500 or 600 feet long and full of pigs. It looks like a normal barn except for the fans along the sides, where you might have windows, blowing out the smell. Banta remembers the first time she caught a whiff.
And to be honest with you, I thought I was going to cry, not because of the physical ailment of it, because the realization that this is what we're going to live with the rest of our lives.
These hog farms are called CAFOs, or Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. Down the road, Banta's neighbor Charlene Eisen says she's worried about their economic impact.
We don't want the value of our home to go down and lose the value of what we do have, you know.
Her 11-year-old grandson Richard says he'd wanted to inherit this house.
Except when that goes there, nobody's going to want to be here. Nobody.
Hope residents brought that up in public hearings about the new farm, but it still got approved. It's a big argument across the state that these CAFOs are good for business but bad for property values. Now, Bartholomew County records don't show an immediate impact on property assessments since the new CAFO was built last year. But it's only the start of the story. Your assessment doesn't change if homes in your neighborhood aren't selling, which local realtor Shirley Wagner says is what happens when you live near a CAFO.
The buyers have backed off totally. They want nothing to do with being close to these properties. If they want to go to the rural setting, they want more a serene environment than that.
That's why some residents, including Nancy Banta, are appealing to make their assessments go down. They argue they shouldn't have to pay the same property taxes to live next to a CAFO. Al Heber is an agricultural engineer at Purdue University who basically wrote the book, well, computer model, on how close you can live to a CAFO before its smell gets annoying. He uses it to help farmers and local officials decide where CAFOs should go. The model makes some pretty obvious predictions. CAFOs with more stinkier animals should be farther from houses. But Heber says it's not practical as a law itself.
Just like I would prefer to change the setback guideline if you add one pig to the facility, I also cannot say that if you walk one more foot away from the facility that because my model puts out a number that you will never experience the odor anymore.
As in many counties, Bartholomew's rules for livestock facilities don't change based on type or quantity of animals. All they say is farms with more than 600 pigs have to be 500 feet from homes. The county's smallest CAFOs contain twice that many hogs. Still, Indiana Farm Bureau livestock specialist Greg Slifer says he tells farmers,
just because you can doesn't mean you should.
But in hope, some farmers did, building about as close as possible to homes like Nancy Banta's. Those farmers either declined to talk or did not respond to repeated requests for comment. This is Hope's only school, where Banta works as a music aide when she's not on shift at the nearby Dollar General. She worries that as the town's population ages, more CAFOs will hurt the property tax rolls and the real estate market and hasten Hope's decline.
And I feel like they're dumping on us because we are poor.
It's tough for her to escape, even at work, because there's a pig farm right across the street. It predates the new setback rules, which will keep CAFOs a quarter mile from any school in the future. On this hot summer day, as in much of Hope, the smell of pigs wafts over the parking lot on the breeze. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Hope.
That comes from IPB News, Indiana Public Broadcasting's statewide network. Annie Ropeek posts her stories at WBAA.org. Startup costs for a new food business can be astronomical, from finding a space to buying equipment to making sure you're in compliance with regulations. Some entrepreneurs have chosen a more frugal route by renting space in a commercial kitchen. Space at the One World Enterprises Kitchen Share in Bloomington, Indiana, has been in such high demand that the owners have finally decided to expand it. I stopped by the new location, a massive building of 44,000 square feet that was originally built to be a textillery. Robin Lasik is the marketing director there.
But let me just walk you through.
Whoa!
Yeah, get ready, because it's amazing. And the smell is the oven, but
okay.
For the kids tonight, we have a bouncy house.
Well, that won't be here every day, right?
It will not.
They're hosting an open house tonight so the community can come and see what this place is all about. The bouncy house is taking up one of the four large bays that food businesses can rent long-term and build into the production facility of their dreams.
You want to go in the bouncy house? We'll go in just a minute, okay?
Jay Burton is the general manager of the kitchen share.
All right, let's take a trip.
Okay. He picks up his four-year-old daughter, Ella, and they take me to the kitchen area.
It's so clean.
It is. It's extremely stainless. The word of the day is stainless, and bless his heart, the owner was down here polishing stainless earlier.
There are three work areas in the kitchen that can be rented by the hour, by the day, or the month. Each has 60 to 80 quart mixer and 17 feet of table space.
So that way you have your prep tables. You've got a three bay dish sink, a two bay prep sink, and a hand sink. You can also reserve resources.
Like the two ranges and the two convection ovens. They also have lots and lots of storage space, dry, cold, and freezer.
So if your stuff needs to be refrigerated, frozen, whatever, we've got you covered.
When Steve Schrader arrives at the open house, he heads immediately to the freezers to store some containers of ice cream.
Here is our walk-in freezer, shared freezer.
His business is Zeitgeist Organic Creamery.
Yeah, it's chilly.
Schrader's rented one of the 2,000 square foot bays here at One World, in which he plans to install ice cream production equipment, office space, and state-of-the-art freezers. This is a universe away from where he started in 2009 when he was making ice cream in his home kitchen. He was commissioned by local brew pub Upland to make a bacon vanilla ice cream.
I spent a month every night in my apartment making bacon. My neighbors thought I was probably nuts, but I fried bacon every night and kept tweaking it, and I finally got it down, and that's when I knew we could take ice creams to levels that most people didn't really realize.
I remember that bacon ice cream from
Upland. You had it?
I sure did have it.
That was my baby. That was my first custom flavor I ever created.
And it came with a slice of chocolate covered
bacon.
Oh my God.
In a glass bowl. And I had tubs of it in my home and business, but I still went there just so I could get the chocolate covered bacon in the ice cream.
He says working in the kitchen share is the reason he's been able to expand his business.
Starting off, I started out of pocket. I didn't want to have a shovel in my hands and go in with major loans. So being able to rent space here, I got a full commercial kitchen without having to go into debt, without having to take on huge loans.
Zeitgeist rented a space in the old kitchen share and was glad to rent an even larger space when One World moved into this new facility this summer. But renting isn't always the best way to go for every business.
For one thing, when you don't own it, you can get kicked out, which is what happened.
Jeff Mees is the founder and CEO of One World. The old kitchen chair building also housed his business's commissary. When their landlord said their lease wasn't getting renewed, Mees had to scramble. It wasn't just small food businesses that would be displaced. It would be the production facility for his 5 pizza delivery locations and Lenny's restaurant. The new facility is now one of 2 buildings his company owns, so they're in this for the long haul. Mees says the idea for a commissary came about back in 1987 as he was expanding Pizza X to a second location. He needed to centralize the production of the pizza dough.
Dough's got to be made. You know, talk to any baker. You know, dough, you just have to make it the same way every time. I mean, it's very finicky.
The commissary allowed them to take things out of the restaurants that were too hard or too labor-intensive to do in each individual kitchen. The result has been a more consistent product. Fast forward to 2010, when Mees paid a visit to the commissary one afternoon.
You know, our crew is gone. They start early and they're gone. You know, a lot of days are gone by 1. So we've got this nice kitchen that sits there from all afternoon and all evening and all night. And then we come back and use it. It's like, I'm like, man, seems like a real waste of this resource. Well, I swear, not a week later, somebody approaches Jay, I think. And Jay tells me, Jay's my commissary manager. Hey, somebody's interested in maybe using our kitchen. Are we into that at all? Like, use our kitchen. This guy wants to. And I'm like, oh, really? Like, I like how that feels. I was just thinking about that.
That first client made peanut brittle. He rented kitchen space for $10 an hour. Soon, word got around and more food businesses joined the kitchen share. They had 8 businesses move with them to this new building, and there are 8 more in the pipeline.
Now, Yugo Bars, one of our original clients, is selling their bars in 17 states. That's money that's coming back here, cycles through again. Now, that helps us pay this mortgage, which helped us buy the building so other people can get started. Do you see how it works? It's a virtuous cycle.
Back at the kitchen share, Tracy Gates and Kayla Cornwell are making Yugo bars. At the old kitchen share, they weren't allowed to come into work until after 2 p.m.
That means we get to work during the day. We're no longer vampires.
In this new space, they're hoping to package 1,500 bars before noon. Mies and I watched as Cornwell put the bars in wrappers. Gates sealed them up. The conveyor belt shoveled them into boxes.
This is a cool coconut.
What do you do with that part?
Eat it. Go ahead. Please.
On any given day in this space, people are making snack bars, frozen fruit pops, cold brew coffee, bagels, and of course pizza dough. Schrader says he's proud to align his ice cream business with fellow locally minded entrepreneurs.
Our little business has taken off really quickly, and this wasn't in the plans, but Jeff Mees has built such an amazing structure here, and it feels right, and to be under his roof, it's an honor.
Look at pictures of the One World Enterprises commissary and kitchen share on our website. It's eartheats.org. Our great team of workers at Earth Eats includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and the wonderful folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Thanks for being here for Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Till next time.